all.
Were you smoking anything? All of you, together?
No, nothing like that. Certainly not together.
Gaze, then? A little something from Jerem's pervert alchemists? A little bliss from a powder?
Tesso never permitted...
Well, then. Barsavi drove a fist into Julien's solar plexus, almost casually. While the man gasped in pain, Barsavi turned away and held up his arms with theatrical joviality. Since we've eliminated every possible earthly explanation for such dereliction of duty, short of sorcery or divine intervention... Oh, forgive me. You weren't enchanted by the gods themselves, were you? They're hard to miss. Julien writhed against his bonds, red-faced, shaking his head.
Please!
No gods, then. Didn't think so. I was saying that your little game is boring the hell out of me. Kindness? The round-headed man lowered his chin to his chest and stood with his palms out, facing upward, as though he were about to receive a gift. I want something creative. If Federico won't talk, let's give Julien one chance to find his tongue.
Federico began screaming before Barsavi had even finished speaking, the high, sobbing wail of the conscious damned. Locke found himself clenching his teeth to keep himself from shaking. So many meetings with slaughter as a backdrop. The gods could be perverse. Sage Kindness moved to a small table to the side of the room, on which there was a pile of small glasses and a heavy cloth sack with a drawstring. Kindness threw several glasses into the sack and began banging it against the table. The sound of breaking, jangling glass wasn't audible beneath Federico's wild hollering, but Locke could imagine it easily enough. After a few moments, Kindness seemed satisfied and walked slowly over to Federico.
Don't, please, no.
With one hand holding the desperate young man's head still, Kindness rapidly drew the bag up over the top of his head, over his face, all the way to Federico's neck, where he cinched the drawstring tight. The bag muffled Federico's screams, which had become high and wordless again. Kindness then began to knead the bag, gently at first, almost tenderly. The torturer's long fingers pushed the jagged contents of the sack up and around Federico's face. Red stains began to appear on the surface of the bag. Kindness manipulated the contents of the sack like a sculptor giving form to his clay. Federico's throat mercifully gave out just then, and for the next few moments the man choked out nothing more than a few hoarse moans. Locke prayed silently that he'd already fled beyond pain to the temporary refuge of madness. Kindness increased the vigor with which he massaged the cloth. He pressed now where Federico's eyes would be, and on the nose and the mouth and the chin. The bag grew wetter and redder until at last Federico's twitching stopped altogether. When Kindness took his hands off the bag, they looked as though he'd been pulping tomatoes. Smiling sadly, he let his red hands drip red trails on the wood, and he walked over to Julien, staring intently, saying nothing.
"Surely," said Kappa Barsavi, "if I've convinced you of anything by this point, it must be the depth of my resolve. Will you not speak?"
"Please, Kappa Barsavi," whispered Julien. "There's no need for this. I have nothing I can tell you. Ask me anything, anything at all. What happened last night is a blank. I don't remember. I would tell you, please, gods, please believe me, I would tell you anything. We are loyal, Pezon, the most loyal you have."
"I sincerely hope not."
Barsavi seemed to come to a decision. He gestured to the Barangius sisters and pointed at Julien. The dark-haired ladies worked quickly and silently, undoing the knots that held him to the wooden frame while leaving the ones that bound him from ankles to neck. They cradled the shivering man effortlessly, one at his shoulders and one at his feet.
"Loyal? Please. We are grown men, Julian. Refusing to tell me the truth of what happened last night is not a loyal act. You've let me down, so I give like for like."
On the far left side of the great hall, a man-sized wooden floor panel had been slid aside. Barely a yard down was the dark surface of the water beneath the grave. The floor around the opening was wet with blood.
"I shall let you down."
Julian screamed one last time as the Barangia sisters heaved him into the opening, head first. He hit the water with a splash and didn't come back up. It was the Kappa's habit to keep something nasty down beneath the grave at all times, constrained there by heavy nets of wire-reinforced rope that surrounded the underside of the galleon like a sieve.
"Kindness, you are dismissed. Boys, when I call you back, you can get some people in here to clean up, but for now go wait on deck. Raiza, Sherin, please go with them."
Moving slowly, Kappa Barsavi walked to his plain, comfortable old chair and settled into it. He was breathing heavily and quivering all the more for his effort not to show it. A brass wine goblet with the capacity of a large soup tureen was set out on the little table beside his chair. The Kappa took a deep draught and seemed to brood over the fumes for a few moments, his eyes closed. At last he came back to life and beckoned for Locke and Nazca to step forward.
"Well, my dear Master Lamora, how much money have you brought me this week?"
7. 36 solons, 5 coppers, Your Honor."
A slender week's work, it seems."
"Yes, with all apologies, Kappa Barsavi. The rain, well, sometimes it's murder on those of us doing second-story work." Barsavi set the goblet down and folded his right hand inside his left, caressing the reddened knuckles.
"You've brought me more, of course. Many times. Better weeks."
Yes.
"There are some that don't, you know. They try to bring me the exact same amount week after week after week, until I finally lose patience and correct them. Do you know what that sort of garista must have, Locke?"
A very boring life."
"Ha! Yes, exactly. How very stable of them to have the exact same income every single week, so they might give me the exact same percentage as a cut, as though I were an infant who would not notice. And then there are garistas such as yourself. I know you bring me the honest percentage, because you're not afraid to walk in here and apologize for having less than last week."
I do hope I'm not considered shy about sharing when the balance tilts the other way."
"Not at all."
Barsavi smiled and settled back in his chair. Ominous splashing and muffling banging was coming from beneath the floor in the vicinity of the hatch that Julian had vanished down.
"You are, if anything, the most reliably correct garista in my service, like Ferrari clockwork. You deliver my cut yourself, promptly and without a summons. For 4 years, week in and week out, unfailing since Chains died. Never once did you suggest that anything took precedence over your personal appearance before me, with that bag in your hand."
Kappa Barsavi pointed at the small leather bag Locke held in his left hand, and gestured to Nazca. Her formal role in the Barsavi organization was to act as finicker, or record keeper. She could rattle off the running total of the payments made by any gang in the city, itemized week by week and year by year without error. Locke knew she updated records on parchment for her father's private use, but so far as the Kappa's subjects in general knew, every coin of his fabled treasure was catalogued solely behind her cold and lovely eyes. Locke tossed the leather purse to her, and she plucked it out of the air.
Never, said Kappa Barsavi, did you think to send a peasant to do a garista's job.
Well, you're most kind, Your Honor. But you made that very easy today, since only garistas are allowed past the door.
Don't dissemble. You know of what I speak. Nazca, love, Locke and I must now be alone.
Nazca gave her father a deep nod, then gave a much quicker, shallower one to Locke. She turned and walked back toward the doors to the entrance hall, iron heels echoing on the wood.
I have many garistas, Barsavi said when she was gone, tougher than yourself. Many more popular, many more charming, many with larger and more profitable gangs, but I have very few who are constantly at pains to be so courteous, so careful.
Locke said nothing.
My young man, while I take offense at many things, rest assured that courtesy is not one of them. Come, stand easy. I'm not fitting you for a noose.
Sorry, Kappa. It's just, you've been known to begin expressing your displeasure in a very,
roundabout fashion?
Chains told me enough about scholars of the Therin Collegium, said Locke, to understand that their primary habit of speech is the, booby trap.
Ah, yes. When anyone tells you habits die hard, Locke, they're lying. It seems they never die at all.
Barsavi chuckled and sipped from his wine before continuing.
These are alarming times, Locke. This damn Grey King has finally begun to get under my skin. The loss of Tesso is particularly... Well, I had plans for him. Now I am forced to begin bringing other plans forward sooner than intended. Tell me, Pezon, what do you think of Andrzej Sanpacero?
Well, my honest opinion, Your Honor?
Full and honest, Pezon, by my command.
Ah, they're very respected, very good at their jobs. Nobody jokes about them behind their backs. Jean says they really know how to handle themselves in a fight. The Sanzas are nervous about playing fair card games with them, which is saying something.
This I could hear from 2 dozen spies any time I wanted to. This I know. What is your personal opinion of my sons?
Locke swallowed and looked Kappa Barsavi straight in the eyes.
Well, they are worthy of respect. They are good at their jobs, and they must know their business in a fight. They're fairly hard workers, and they're bright enough. But, Your Honor, begging your pardon, they tease Nazca when they should be heeding her warnings and taking her advice. She has the patience and the subtlety that
elude them?
You knew what I was going to say, didn't you? I said you were a careful and considerate garista, Locke. Those are your distinguishing characteristics, though they imply many other qualities. Since the time of your prodigious early cock-ups, you have been the very picture of a careful thief, firmly in control of his own greed. You would be very sensitive to any opposing lack of caution in others. My sons have lived all their lives in a city that fears them because of their last name. They expect deference in an aristocratic fashion. They are incautious, a bit brazen. I need to make arrangements to ensure that they receive good counsel in the months and years to come. I can't live forever, even after I deal with the Grey King.
The jovial certainty that filled Kappa Barsavi's voice when he said this made the hair on the back of Locke's neck stand up. The Kappa was sitting in a fortress he hadn't left in more than 2 months, drinking wine in air still rank with the blood of 8 members of one of his most powerful and loyal gangs. Was Locke speaking to a man with a far-ranging and subtle scheme? Or had Barsavi finally cracked, like window glass in a fire?
I should very much like, said the Kappa, to have you in a position to give Andrzej Sanpacero the counsel they'll require.
Ah, Your Honor, that's extremely...
Flattering, but I get along well enough with Andres and Pachero, but I'm not exactly what you'd call a close friend. We play some cards every now and then, but let's be honest, I'm not a very important garista. As I said, even with the Grey King at work in my city, I have many who are tougher than you, more daring than you, more popular. I don't say this to strike a blow, because I've already discussed your own qualities. And it is those qualities they sorely need. Not toughness, daring, or charm, but cold and steady caution. Prudence. You are my most prudent garista. You only think of yourself as the least important because you make the least noise. Tell me now, what do you think of Nazca?
Nazca?
Locke was suddenly even warier than before. She's brilliant, Your Honor. She can recite conversations we had 10 years ago and get every word right, especially if it embarrasses me. You think I'm prudent? Compared to her, I'm as reckless as a bear in an alchemist's lab.
Yes, said the Kappa. Yes. She should be the next Kappa Barsavi when I'm gone, but that won't happen. It's nothing to do with her being a woman, you know. Her older brothers would simply never stand to have their little sister lording it over them. And I should prefer not to have my children murdering one another for scraps of the legacy I intend to leave them, so I cannot push them aside in her favor. What I can do, and what I must do, is ensure that when the time comes, they will have a voice of sobriety in such a place that they cannot get rid of it. You and Nazca are old friends, yes? I remember the first time you met, so many years ago, when she used to sit on my knee and pretend to order my men around. In all the years since, you have always stopped to see her, always given her kind words, always been her good peasant.
I certainly hope so, Your Honor.
I know you have.
Barsavi took a deep draught from his wine goblet, then set it back down firmly, a magnanimous smile on his round, wrinkled face.
And so I give you my permission to court my daughter.
Let's start wobbling, shall we? Said Locke's knees,
but this offer was met by a counterproposal from his better judgment to simply freeze up and do nothing, like a man treading water who sees a tall black fin coming straight at him.
"Oh," he finally said, I didn't expect...
"Of course not," said Barsavi, "but in this our purposes are complementary. I know you and Nazca have feelings for one another. A union between the two of you would bring you into the Barsavi family. You would become Andres and Pachero's responsibility, and they yours. Don't you see? A brother by bonding would be much harder for them to ignore than even their most powerful garista."
Barsavi set his left fist inside his right and smiled broadly once again, like a red-faced god dispensing benevolence from a celestial throne. Locke took a deep breath. There was nothing else for it. The situation required absolute acquiescence, as surely as if the Kappa were holding a crossbow to his temple. Men died for refusing Barsavi far less. To refuse the Kappa's own daughter would be a particularly messy sort of suicide. If Locke balked at the Kappa's plan, he wouldn't live out the night.
I'm honored, Kappa Barsavi. So deeply honored. I hope not to disappoint you.
Disappoint me? Certainly not. Now, I know that several of my other garistas have had their eyes on Nazca for some time, but if one of them were going to catch her eye, he'd have done it by now, eh? What a surprise when they hear the news. They'll never see this coming.
And for a wedding present, thought Locke, the angry jealousy of an unknown number of jilted suitors.
How and when should I begin, Your Honor?
Well, said Barsavi, why don't I give you a few days to think it over? I'll speak to her in the interim. Of course, for the time being, she's not to leave the floating grave. Once the Grey King is dealt with, well, I would expect you to begin courting her in a more colourful and public fashion.
You're telling me, Locke said very carefully, I should start stealing more, then.
Consider it my challenge to you to go hand in hand with my blessing.
Barsavi smirked.
Let's see if you can stay prudent while becoming more productive. I suspect you can, and I know that you wouldn't want to disappoint me or my daughter.
Certainly not, Your Honor. I'll do my very best.
Kappa Barsavi beckoned Locke forward and held his left hand out. Fingers outstretched, palm down. Locke knelt before Barsavi's chair, took that hand with both of his own, and kissed the Kappa's ring, that familiar black pearl with the blood-red heart.
Kappa Barsavi,
he said with his eyes to the ground. The Kappa pulled him up again by the shoulders.
I give you my blessing, Locke Lamora. The blessing of an old man who worries for his children. I set you above many dangerous people by doing this for you. Surely it has occurred to you that my sons will inherit a dangerous office. And if they're not careful enough or hard enough for the task, well, stranger things have happened. Some day this city could be ruled by Kappa Lamora. Have you ever dreamed of this?
Truthfully, whispered Locke, I've never desired a Kappa's power because I would never want a Kappa's problems.
Well, there's that prudence again.
The Kappa smiled and gestured toward the far doors, giving Locke permission to withdraw.
A Kappa's problems are very real, but you've helped me put one of them to rest.
Locke walked back toward the entrance hall, thoughts racing. The Kappa sat on his chair behind him, staring at nothing, saying no more. The only sounds after that were Locke's own footsteps and the steady drip of blood from the gore-soaked bag around Federico's head.
8. Well, Nazca, if I were 1,000 years old and had already seen everything there is to see 6 times over, that still would have been about the last damn thing I'd have ever expected.
She was waiting for him in the little hall beyond the foyer, once the clockwork mechanisms had sealed the door to the main hall behind them. She gave him a wry and apologetic look.
But don't you see that it would have been even stranger if I'd explained it beforehand?
The whole mess would be hard-pressed to get any god's damned weirder.
Look, please, don't take any of this the wrong way. I don't take any of it the wrong way, Locke. You're a good friend, and I feel the same way, and yet it's hard to put this right. No, it isn't. Look.
She grabbed him by the shoulders and bent down slightly to look right into his eyes.
You are a good friend, Locke. Probably the best I have. My loyal Pezon. I'm extremely fond of you, but not as a possible husband. And I know that you...
Locke,
said Nazca, I know that the only woman with the key to that peculiar heart of yours is 1,000 miles away, and I know you'd rather be miserable over her than happy with anyone else.
Really? Locke balled his fists. Seems like it's pretty common fucking knowledge. I bet the Duke gets regular reports. Seems as though your father is the only person who doesn't know.
Or doesn't care. Nazca raised her eyebrows. Locke, it's Kappa de Pezon. It's not personal. He gives the orders and you carry them out, in most cases.
But not this one? I thought you'd be happy. At least he's making plans for the future again.
I said reasonable plans.
Nazca smiled, a real smile this time.
Come on, Pezon, play along for a few days. We can go through the motions and put our heads together to come up with a way out of this. It's you and me we're talking about, right? The old man can't win, and he won't even know he's lost.
Right, if you say so.
Yes, I say so. Come back the day after tomorrow. We'll scheme. We'll slip this noose.
Now go tend to your boys, and be careful.
Locke stepped back out into the entrance hall, and Nazca pushed the doors shut behind him. He stared back at her as the space between the black doors narrowed, gradually sealing her off from view until they slammed shut with the click of tumbling locks. He could have sworn she winked just before the heavy black doors closed between them.
"And this is the card you picked, the Six of Spires," said Carlo, holding up a card and displaying it for the entrance hall guards.
"Fuck me," said one of them. "That's sorcery."
"Nah, it's just the old sun's a touch."
Carlo reshuffled his deck one-handed and held it out toward Locke.
"Care to give it a go, boss?"
"No thanks, Carlo."
"Pack up, lads. Our business here is finished for the day, so let's quit bothering the folks with the crossbows."
He punctuated this with hand gestures. "Major complications. Discuss elsewhere."
"Damn, I'm hungry," said Jean, picking up the cue. "Why don't we get something at the last mistake and take it up to our rooms?"
"Yeah," said Bug. "Beer and apricot tarts."
"A combination so disgusting I feel oddly compelled to actually try it."
Jean swatted the smallest gentleman bastard on the back of his head, then led the way as the gang made for the slender wooden path that tied the floating grave to the rest of the world.
9.
Save Kappa Barsavi, who imagined that Locke's gang merely continued sitting the steps a few days of the week, even with chains in his grave, no right people of Camor knew that the gentleman bastard still worked out of the house of Perelandro. Carlo and Galdo and Bug let rooms at various points in and around the snare, moving every few months. Locke and Jean had maintained the fiction of rooming together for several years. By a great stroke of luck, though whether it was good or ill had yet to be determined, really, Jean had managed to get them the rooms on the 7th floor of the broken tower. The night was dark and full of rain, and none of the gang were particularly eager to make their way back onto the creaking exterior stairs that staggered down the north side of the tower. Hissing rain rattled the window shutters, and the wind made an eerie rising and falling sigh as it passed over the gaps and crevices in the old tower. The gentleman bastard sat on floor cushions in the light of paper lanterns and nursed the last of their beer, the pale, sweet sort that most Camor natives preferred to the bitter Varari dark. The air was stuffy, but at least tolerably dry. Locke had given them the whole story over dinner.
"Well," said Galdo, "this is the damnedest damned thing that ever damned things up for us."
"I say again," said Jean, "that we should pull an early blow-off on the Don Salvara game and get ready to ride out a storm. This Grey King business is getting scary, and we can't have our attention diverted if Locke's going to be mixed up at the middle of things."
"Where do we cut ourselves off?" asked Carlo.
"We cut ourselves off now," said Jean. "Now, or after we get one more note out of the Don. No later."
"Hmm."
Locke stared down at the dregs in the bottom of his tin cup.
"We've worked hard for this one. I'm confident we can run it for another 5,000 or 10,000 crowns, at least. Maybe not the 25,000 we were hoping to squeeze out of Salvara, but enough to make ourselves proud. I got the crap kicked out of me, and Bug jumped off a building for this money, you know."
"And got rolled 2 miles inside a bloody barrel!"
"Now, Bug," said Galdo, "it's not as though the nasty old barrel jumped you in an alley and forced you to crawl inside it. And I concur with Jean. I said it this afternoon, Locke. Even if you won't seriously consider using them, can we at least make some arrangements to get you under cover in a hurry? Maybe even out of town?"
"I still can't believe I'm hearing a Sansa council caution," Locke said with a grin. "I thought we were richer and cleverer than everyone else."
"You'll hear it again and again when there's a chance you'll get your throat slit, Locke."
Carlo picked up his brother's argument.
"I've changed my mind about the Grey King, that's for damn sure. Maybe the lone lunatic does have it over the 3,000 of us. You might be one of his targets, and if Barsavi wants you even tighter with his inner circle, it invites further trouble."
Can we set aside talk of slitting throats just for a moment? Locke rose and turned toward the shuttered seaward window. He pretended to stare out of it with his hands folded behind his back. Who are we, after all? I admit, I was almost ready to jump into the God's damned bay when the Kappa sprang this on me. But I've had time to think, so get this straight. We've got the old fox dead to rights. We've got him in the palms of our hands. Honestly, boys, we're so good at what we do that he's asking the Thorn of fucking Camorra to marry his daughter. We're so far in the clear, it's comical. Nonetheless, said Jean, it's a complication that could mess up our arrangements forever, not an accomplishment we can crow about. Of course we can crow about it, Jean. I'm going to crow about it right now. Don't you see? This is nothing we don't do every day. It's a plain old gentleman bastard sort of job, only we'll have Nazca working with me to pull it off as well. We can't lose. I'm no more likely to marry her than I am to be named Duke Nicovanti's heir tomorrow morning. Do you have a plan? Jean's eyes said he was curious but wary. Not even remotely. I don't have the first damn clue what we're going to do. But all my best plans start just like this. Locke tipped the last of his beer down his throat and tossed the tin cup against the wall. I've had my beer and I've had my apricot tarts, and I say the hell with them both, Grey King and Kappa Barsavi. Nobody's going to scare us out of our Don Salvara game, and nobody's going to hitch me and Nazca against our will. We'll do what we always do, wait for an opening, take it, and fucking well win. Well, Jean sighed. Will you at least let us take a few precautions? And will you watch yourself coming and going? Naturally, Jean, naturally. You grab us some places on likely ships. Spend whatever you have to. I don't care where they're going as long as it's not Jerem. We can lose ourselves anywhere for a few weeks and creep back when we please. Carlo, Galdo, you get out to the Viscount's gate tomorrow. Leave some considerations for the boys in yellow so we can get out of the city at an awkward hour if we need to. Don't be shy with the silver and gold. What can I do? Asked Bug. You can watch our backs. Keep your eyes wide open. Skulk around the temple. Spot me anyone out of place, anyone who lingers too long. If anyone is trying to keep an eye on us, I guarantee we will go to ground and vanish like piss into the ocean. Until then, trust me. I promise to do most of my moving around as Lucas Fairwhite for the next few days. I can swap in some cheaper disguises, too. Then I suppose that's that, Jean said quietly. Jean, I can be your garista, or I can just be the fellow who buys beer and tarts when everyone else mysteriously misplaces their purses. Locke eyed the gathering with an exaggerated scowl. I can't be both. It's one or the other. I'm nervous, said Jean, because I don't like having as little information as I fear we do. I share Nazca's suspicions. The Grey King has something up his sleeves, something we don't understand. Our game is very delicate and our situation is very fluid. I know, but I follow my gut, and my gut says that we meet this one head on with smiles on our faces. Look, said Locke. The more we do this, the more I learn about what I think Chains was really training us for. And this is it. He wasn't training us for a calm and orderly world where we could pick and choose when we needed to be clever. He was training us for a situation that was fucked up on all sides. Well, we're in it, and I say we're equal to it. I don't need to be reminded that we're up to our heads in dark water. I just want you boys to remember that we're the God's damned sharks. "Right on!" cried Bug. "I knew there was a reason I let you lead this gang!" "Well, I can't argue with the manifest wisdom of the boy that jumps off temple roofs, but I trust my points are noted," said Jean. "Very noted," said Locke. "Received, recognized, and duly considered with the utmost gravity. Sealed, notarized, and firmly imprinted upon my rational essence." "Gods, you really are cheerful about this, aren't you?" You only play vocabulary games when you feel genuinely sunny about the world. Jean sighed, but couldn't keep the slightest hint of a smile from tugging at the corners of his lips.
If you do end up in danger, Locke, said Carlo, you must understand that we will ignore the orders of our garista and will bludgeon our friend on the back of his thick skull and smuggle him out of Camor in a box. I have just the bludgeon for the job. And I have a box, said Galdo. Been hoping for an excuse to use it for years, really.
Also noted, said Locke, with thanks. But by the grace of the crooked warden, I choose to trust us. I choose to trust Chain's judgment. I choose to keep doing what we do best. Tomorrow I've got some work to do as Fairwhite, and then I'll go see Nazca again the day after. The Kappa will be expecting it, and I'm sure she'll have some ideas of her own by then. Locke thought once again of his last glimpse of her, that wink as the two great doors of dark wood slammed shut between them. Maintaining her father's secrets was Nazca's entire life. Did it mean something for her to have one of her own that she could keep from him? Interlude. The Boy Who Cried for a Corpse. 1. Father Chains gave Locke no respite from his education on the day after the visit to the last mistake. With his head still pounding from a brown sugar rum headache, Locke began to learn about the priesthood of Perelandro and the priesthood of the Benefactor. There were hand signs and ritual intonations, methods of greeting and meanings behind robe decorations. On his fourth day in Chain's care, Locke began to sit the steps as one of the initiates of Perelandro, clad in white and trying to look suitably humble and pathetic. As the weeks passed, the breadth of Chain's instruction expanded. Locke did 2 hours of reading and scribing each day. His pen scratchings grew smoother step by halting step, until the Sansa brothers announced that he no longer wrote, "Like a dog with an arrow in its brain." Locke was moved enough by their praise to dust their sleeping palates with red pepper. The Sansas were distraught when their attempted retaliation was foiled by the utter paranoia Locke still carried with him from his experiences in Shade's Hill and the Catchfire Plague. It was simply impossible to sneak up on him or catch him sleeping. "The brothers have never before met their match in mischief," said Chains, as he and Locke sat the steps one particularly slow day. "Now they're wary of you. When they start coming to you for advice, well, that's when you'll know that you have them tamed." Locke had smiled and said nothing. Just that morning, Carlo had offered to give Locke extra help with his sums, if the smallest gentleman bastard would only tell the twins how he kept spotting their little booby traps and rendering them harmless. Locke revealed precious few of his survival tricks, but he did accept the help of both Sansas in his study of arithmetic. His only reward for each accomplishment was a more complex problem from Chains. At the same time, he began his education in spoken Vardran. Chains would issue simple commands in the language, and once Locke was reasonably familiar with the tongue, Chains often forbade the three boys to speak anything else for hours at a time. Even their dinner conversation was conducted in the harsh and illogical language of the North. To Locke, it often seemed impossible to say anything in Vardran that didn't sound angry. "You won't hear this among the right people much, but you'll hear it on the docks and among the merchants, that's for damn sure," said Chains. "And when you hear someone speaking it, don't ever let on that you know it, unless you absolutely have to. You'd be surprised how arrogant some of those northern types are when it comes to their speech. Just play dumb, and you never know what they might let slip." There was more instruction in the culinary arts. Chains had Locke slaving away at the cooking hearth every other night, with Carlo and Galdo vigorously henpecking him in tandem. "This is Vice Aloapona, the fifth beautiful art of Camor," said Chains. "Guild chefs learn all 8 styles better than they learn the uses of their own cocks, but you'll just get the basics for now.
Mind you, our basics piss on everyone else's best. Only Carthane and Emberlane come close. Most Vardrans wouldn't know fine cuisine from rat shit in lamp oil. Now, this is pinch of gold pepper, and this is Jereshti olive oil, and just behind them I keep dried cinnamon lemon rind. Lock stewed octopus and boiled potatoes. He sliced pears and apples and alchemical hybrid fruit that oozed honey-scented liquor. He spiced and seasoned and bit his tongue in furious concentration. He was frequently the architect of gruesome messes that were hauled out behind the temple and fed to the goat. But as he improved at everything else required of him, he improved steadily at the hearth. Soon the Sansas ceased to tease him and began to trust him as an assistant with their own delicate creations. One night, about half a year after his arrival at the House of Perelandro, Locke and the Sansas collaborated on a stuffed platter of infant sharks. This was vice entemere, the first beautiful art, the cuisine of sea creatures. Carlo gutted the soft-skinned little sharks and stuffed them with red and yellow peppers, which had in turn been stuffed with sausage and blood cheese by Locke. The tiny staring eyes of the creatures were replaced with black olives. Once the little teeth were plucked out, their mouths were stuffed with glazed carrots and rice, and their fins and tails were cut off to be boiled in soup. "Ah," said Chains, when the elaborate meal was settling in four appreciative gullets. "Now that was genuinely excellent, boys. But while you're cleaning up and scouring the dishes, I only want to hear you speaking Vardran." And so it went. Locke was schooled further in the art of setting a table and waiting on individuals of high station. He learned how to hold out a chair and how to pour tea and wine. He and the Sansas conducted elaborate dinner table rituals with the gravity of physicers cutting open a patient. There were lessons in clothing, the tying of cravats, the buckling of shoes, the wearing of expensive affectations such as hose. In fact, there was a dizzying variety of instruction in virtually every sphere of human accomplishment except thievery. As the first anniversary of Locke's arrival at the temple loomed, that changed. "I owe some favours, boys," said Chains one night as they all hunkered down in the lifeless rooftop garden. This was where he preferred to discuss all the weightier matters of their life together, at least when it wasn't raining. "Favours I can't put off when certain people come calling."
"Like the Kappa?" asked Locke.
"Not this time." Chains took a long drag on his habitual after-dinner smoke. "This time I owe the Black Alchemists. You know about them, right?"
Carlo and Galdo nodded, but hesitantly. Locke shook his head.
"Well," said Chains, "there's a right and proper guild of alchemists, but they're very choosy about the sort of person they let in, and the sort of work they let them do. Black alchemists are sort of the reason the guild has such strict rules. They do business in false shop fronts with people like us, drugs, poisons, what have you. The Kappa owns them, same as he owns us, but nobody really leans on them directly. They're, not the sort of people you want to upset. Jesseline Dorbar is probably the best of the lot. I had occasion to get poisoned once. She took care of it for me, so I owe her, and she's finally called in the favor. What she wants is a corpse."
"Beggar's barrow," said Carlo.
"And a shovel,"
said Galdo.
"No, she needs a fresh corpse, still warm and juicy, as it were. See, the guilds of alchemists and physicers are entitled to a certain number of fresh corpses each year by ducal charter. Straight off the gallows for cutting open and poking around. The black alchemists don't receive any such courtesy, and Jesseline has some theories she wants to put to the test. So I've decided you boys are going to work together on your first real job. I want you to find a corpse, fresher than morning bread. Get your hands on it without attracting undue attention, and bring it here so I can hand it off to Jessalyn.
"Steal a corpse? This won't be any fun," said Galdo.
"Think of it as a valuable test of your skills," said Chains.
"Are we likely to steal many corpses in the future?" asked Carlo.
"It's not a test of your corpse-plucking abilities, you cheeky little nitwit," Chains said amiably. "I mean to see how you all work together on something more serious than our dinner. I'll consider setting you up with anything you ask for, but I'm not giving you hints. You get to figure this one out on your own."
"Anything we ask for?" said Locke.
"Within reason," said Chains. "And let me emphasize that you can't make the corpse yourself. You have to find it honestly dead by someone else's doing." So forceful was Chain's voice when he said this that the Sansa brothers stared warily at Locke for a few seconds, then gave each other a look with eyebrows arched.
"When," said Locke, "does this lady want it by?"
"She'd be very pleased to have it in the next week or so." Locke nodded, then stared down at his hands for a few seconds.
"Carlo, Galdo," he said, "will you sit the steps tomorrow so I can think about this?" "Yes," they said without hesitation, and Father Chains didn't miss the note of hope in their voices.
He would remember that moment ever after, the night the Sansas conceded that Locke would be the brains of their operation, the night they were relieved to have him as the brains of their operation.
"Honestly dead," said Locke, "and not killed by us, and not even stiff yet. Right. I know we can do it. It'll be easy. I just don't know why or how yet."
"Your confidence heartens me," said Chains. "But I want you to remember that you're on a very short leash. If a tavern should happen to burn down or a riot should happen to break out around you, I'll throw you off this roof with lead ingots tied around your neck." Carlo and Galdo stared at Locke once again.
"Short leash, right. But don't worry," said Locke. "I'm not as reckless as I was. You know, when I was little."
2. The next day Locke walked the length of the temple district on his own for the very first time, hooded in a clean white robe of Perelandro's order with silvery embroidery on the sleeves, waist high to virtually everyone around him. He was astonished at the courtesy given to the robe, a courtesy he clearly understood that in many cases only partially devolved on the poor fool wearing the robe. Most Camorri regarded the Order of Perelandro with a mixture of cynicism and guilty pity. The unabashed charity of the god and his priesthood just didn't speak to the rough heart of the city's character. Yet the reputation of Father Chains as a colourful freak of piety paid certain dividends. Men who surely joked about the simpering of the beggar god's white-robed priests with their friends nonetheless threw coins into Chains' kettle, eyes averted when they passed his temple. It turned out they also let a little robed initiate pass on the street without harassment. Groups parted fluidly and merchants nodded almost politely as Locke went on his way. For the first time he learned what a powerful thrill it was to go about in public in an effective disguise. The sun was creeping upward toward noon. The crowds were thick and the city was alive with the echoes and murmurs of its masses. Locke padded intently to the southwest corner of the temple district, where a glass cat bridge arched across the canal to the island of the old citadel. Cat bridges were another legacy of the Eldrin who'd ruled before the coming of men. Narrow glass arches no wider than an ordinary man's hips, arranged in pairs over most of Camor's canals and at several places along the Angevin River. Although they looked smooth, their glimmering surfaces were as rough as shark's hide leather. For those with a reasonable measure of agility and confidence, they provided the only convenient means of crossing water at many points. Traffic was always one-directional over each cat bridge. Ducal decree clearly stated that anyone going the wrong direction could be shoved off by those with the right of way. As he scuttled across this bridge, pondering furiously, Locke recalled some of the history lessons Chains had drilled into him.
The old citadel district had once been the home of the Dukes of Comor, centuries earlier, when all the city-states claimed by the Therin people had knelt to a single throne in the imperial city of Therim Pell. That line of Comorian nobility, in superstitious dread of the perfectly good glass towers left behind by the Eldrin, had erected a massive stone palace in the heart of southern Comor. When one of Nicovante's great-great predecessors, on finer points of city law such as this, Locke's undeniably prodigious knowledge dissolved in a haze of total indifference, took up residence in the silver glass tower called Raven's Reach, the old family fortress had become the Palace of Patience, the heart of Comor's municipal justice such as it was. The Yellow Jackets and their officers were headquartered there, as were the Duke's magistrates, 12 men and women who presided over their cases in scarlet robes and velvet masks, their true identities never to be revealed to the general public. Each was named for one of the months of the year, Justice Parthis, Justice Festal, Justice Aurim, and so forth, though each one passed judgment year-round. And there were dungeons, and there were the gallows on the Black Bridge that led to the palace gates, and there were other things. While the secret peace had greatly reduced the number of people who took the short, sharp drop off the Black Bridge, and didn't Duke Nicovante love to publicly pin that on his own magnanimity, the Duke's servants had devised other punishments that were spectacular in their cruel cleverness, if technically non-lethal. The palace was a great square heap of pitted black and grey stone, 10 stories high. The huge bricks that formed its walls had been arranged into simple mosaics that had now weathered to a ghostly state. The rows of high arched windows that decorated every other level of the tower were stained glass, with black and red designs predominating. At night a light would burn ominously behind each one, dim red eyes in the darkness, staring out in all directions. Those windows were never dark. The intended message was clear. There were 4 open-topped circular towers jutting out from each corner of the palace, seemingly hanging in air from the 6th or 7th level up. On the sides of these hung black iron crow cages, in which prisoners singled out for special mistreatment would be aired out for a few hours or even a few days, with their feet dangling. Yet even these were seats in paradise compared to the spider cages, a spectacle that became visible to Locke between the backs and shoulders of adults as he stepped off the catbridge and into the crowds of the old citadel. From the southeastern tower of the Palace of Patience were dangled a 6 cages on long steel chains, swaying gently in the wind like little spiders on cords of silk. 2 of these were moving, one slowly headed up and the other rapidly descending. Prisoners condemned to the spider cages were not to be allowed a moment's peace, so other prisoners condemned to hard labour would toil at the huge capstans atop the tower, working in shifts around the clock until a subject in a cage was deemed to be sufficiently unhinged and contrite. Lurching and creaking and open to the elements on all sides, the cages would go up and down ceaselessly. At night one could frequently hear the occupants pleading and screaming, even from a district or two away. The old citadel wasn't a very cosmopolitan district. Outside the Palace of Patience there were canal docks and stables reserved for the Yellow Jackets, offices for the Duke's tax collectors and scribes and other functionaries, and seedy little coffee houses where freelance solicitors and law scribes would try to drum up work from the families and friends of those being held in the palace. A few pawn shops and other businesses clung tenaciously to the northern part of the island, but for the most part they were crowded out by the grimmer business of the Duke's government. The district's other major landmark was the Black Bridge that spanned the wide canal between Old Citadel and the Mara Camorazza. A tall arch of black human-set stone adorned with red lamps that were fixed up with ceremonial black shrouds that could be lowered with a few tugs on a rope. The hangings were conducted from a wooden platform that jutted off the bridge's south side. Supposedly, the unquiet shades of the condemned would be carried out to sea if they died over running water. Some thought that they would then be incarnated in the bodies of sharks, which explained why Comor Bay had such a problem with the creatures, and the idea was not entirely scoffed at. As far as most Comori were concerned, Turnabout was fair play. Locke stared at the black bridge for a good long while, exercising that capacity for conniving that Chains had so forcefully repressed for many long months. He was far too young for much self-analysis, but the process of scheming gave him real pleasure, like a little ball of tingling warmth in the pit of his stomach. He had no name for what he was doing, but in the collision of his whirling thoughts a plan began to form, and the more he thought on it, the more pleased he became with himself. It was a fine thing that his white hood concealed his face from most passers-by, lest anyone should see an initiate of Perelandro staring fixedly at a gallows and grinning wildly. 3. "I need the names of any men who are going to hang in the next week or two," said Locke, as he and Chains set the temple steps the next day.
"If you were enterprising," said Chains, "and you most certainly are, you could get them yourself and leave your poor fat old master in peace."
"I would, but I need someone else to do it. It won't work if I'm seen around the Palace of Patience before the hangings."
"What won't work?"
"The plan."
"Oh-ho! Nervy little Shades Hill purse-clutcher, thinking you can keep me in the dark? What plan?"
"The plan to steal a corpse."
"Ahem. Anything else you'd like to tell me about it?"
"It's brilliant."
A passer-by tossed something into the kettle. Locke bowed and Chains waved his hands in the man's general direction, his restraints clattering, and yelled,
50 years of health to you and your children, and the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked!"
"It would have been 100 years, muttered Chains when the man had passed, but that sounded like a clipped half-copper.
"Now, your brilliant plan. I know you've had audacious plans, but I'm not entirely sure you've had a brilliant one yet."
"This is the one, then. Honest, but I need those names."
"If it's so, it's so."
Chains leaned backward and stretched, grunting in satisfaction as his back creaked and popped.
"I'll get them for you tonight."
"And I'll need some money."
"Ah, well, I expected that. Take what you need from the vault and mark it on the ledger. Screw around with it, though."
"I know. Lead ingots. Screaming. Death."
"Something like that.
You're a little on the small side, but I suppose Jessalyn might learn a thing or two from your corpse anyway." 4. Penance Day was the traditional day for hangings in Camor. Each week a sullen handful of prisoners would be trotted out from the Palace of Patience, priests and guards surrounding them. Noon was the hour of the drop. At the 8th hour of the morning, when the functionaries in the courtyard of the palace threw open their wooden shutters and settled in for a long day of saying, "Fuck off in the name of the Duke," to all comers, 3 robed initiates of Perelandro wheeled a narrow wooden pull-cart into the courtyard. The smallest of the 3 made his way over to the first available clerk. His thin little face barely topped the forward edge of the clerk's booth.
"Well, this is odd," said the clerk,
a woman of late middle years, shaped something like a bag of potatoes, but perhaps not quite as warm or sympathetic.
"Help you with something?"
"There's a man being hanged," said Locke. "Noon today."
"You don't say. Here I thought it was a state secret."
"His name's Antrim. Antrim One Hand, they call him. He's got..."
"One hand? Yes, he drops today. Fire-setting, theft, dealing with slavers. Charming man."
"I was going to say that he had a wife," said Locke. "She has business. About him."
"Look, the time for appeals is past. Saris, Festal, and Tathris sealed the death warrant. Antrim One Hand belongs to Morgante now, and then to Azaguia. Not even one of the beggar god's cute little sprats can help him at this point."
"I know," said Locke. "I don't want him spared. His wife doesn't care if he gets hanged. I'm here about the body."
"Really?"
Genuine curiosity flickered in the clerk's eyes for the first time.
Now that is odd. What about the body? His wife knows he deserves to get hanged, but she wants him to get a fairer chance. You know, with the Lady of the Long Silence. So she's paid for us to take the body and put it in our temple, so we can burn candles and pray for intercession in Perelandro's name for 3 days and nights. We'll bury him after that. Well, no, said the clerk. The corpses usually get cut down after an hour and tossed into holes on the beggar's barrow. More than they deserve, but it's tidy. We don't usually just go handing them out to anyone who wants one. I know. My master cannot see or leave our temple, or else he'd be here to explain himself. But where all he has? I'm supposed to say that he knows this is making trouble for you.
Locke's little hand appeared over the edge of the booth, and when it withdrew, a small leather purse was sitting on the clerk's counting board.
That's very considerate of him. We all know how devoted old Father Chains is.
The clerk swept the purse behind her counter and gave it a shake. It jingled, and she grunted.
Still a bit of a problem, though. My master would be grateful for any help you could give us.
Another purse appeared on the counter, and the clerk actually broke a smile.
It's within the realm of possibility, she said. Not quite certain yet, of course.
Locke conjured a third purse, and the clerk nodded.
I'll speak to the masters of the ropes, little one. We even brought our own cart, said Locke. We don't want to be any trouble. I'm sure you won't be.
Her demeanour softened for just a moment.
I didn't mean ill by what I said about the beggar god boy. I didn't take it ill, madam. After all, it's what we do.
He favoured her with what he thought was his most endearing little grin.
Did you not give me what I asked for, because I begged, simply out of the goodness of your own heart, with no coin involved? Why, of course I did.
She actually winked at him.
20 years of health to you and your children,
Locke said, bowing and briefly disappearing beneath the lip of her counter.
And the blessings of the Lord of the Overlooked.
5. It was a short, neat hanging. The Duke's masters of the ropes were nothing if not well practised at their trade. It wasn't the first execution Locke had ever seen, nor would it be the last. He and the Sansa brothers even had a chance to make all the proper reverential gestures when one of the condemned begged for Perelandro's blessings at the last minute. Traffic across the Black Bridge was halted for executions. A small crowd of guards